C'est donc un très très grand plaisir d'accueillir dans le cadre de mon séminaire Saskia Peels tout d'abord, Saskia Peels Mathé. Alors Saskia est diplômée en philologie classique et en linguistique. Cette diplomation est intervenue aux Pays-Bas entre Leiden et Utrecht. Elle a soutenu en 2013 un doctorat sur la notion de Hosios, justement, dont elle va nous parler aujourd'hui. J'avais le privilège d'être dans le jury de thèse, donc c'est comme ça qu'on s'est connus. Enfin, on s'était connus avant, mais c'est surtout autour de la thèse que nous avons vraiment fait connaissance. Et on a tellement bien fait connaissance que j'ai proposé à Saskia de venir poursuivre sa formation dans le cadre d'un postdoc à l'Université de Liège, dans le cadre du projet Collection of Greek Ritual Norms. Et donc, Saskia est restée 3 années à Liège. Nous sommes donc des collaboratrices de longue date. Et depuis 2017, Saskia est assistant professor à l'Université de Groningen, aux Pays-Bas, et poursuit donc ses assistant professor en linguistique grecque. Et elle poursuit ses recherches sur toutes ces questions, avec toujours un regard sur la piété grecque par le biais de l'usage du vocabulaire. Et donc, je lui laisse immédiatement la parole pour nous entretenir de ces questions passionnantes. C'est à toi, Saskia.
Thank you so much for inviting me here and for listening to me. My talk today is about the semantics of ancient Greek words that express the notion of piety. In particular, we will discuss hosios and its cognates, and we will compare the usage of these words to those of themis and its cognates. And with this as a case study, we will focus on how to approach the study of lexical semantics in a dead language. We will address mostly the period between Homer and the end of the 5th century BC, and also we focus mostly on literary evidence. The talk is based on my book and on a later article. You will see it at the end in the bibliography. So we will start with some theory. In modern scholarship on lexical semantics, we can distinguish two types of views: minimalist and maximalist approaches to lexical meaning. Those in favor of a minimalist or monosemous approach assume that an entry in the mental lexicon, this is the dictionary in our heads, is a single, highly abstract, underspecified description of the meaning of a lexeme, a word. For example, the meaning of the word clear may be mentally represented by the underdescriptive somehow transparent. While a concrete and full interpretation of clear is reached ad hoc in specific discourse contexts. Minimalist approaches do not allow for lexical polysemy. That means meaning words having more than one meaning stored in the mental lexicon. Having more than one meaning stored in the lexical entry, sorry. Instead, they view polysemy as a pragmatic phenomenon, hinging on specific contextual information and general derivational rules for word use, for example, metaphoric use. By contrast, the maximalist point of view proposed by cognitive linguists, which we will follow today, is that the representation of the meaning of a word in the mind of a language user is not a formal definition. Rather, it is an inventory of situations in which one has heard a particular word. Interpretation then becomes a matter of accessing these stored meanings. Note that this view of lexical semantics entails that there is no principled distinction between semantics, abstract meaning, and pragmatics, concrete usages, because knowledge about the meaning of a word is knowledge about how that word is used. As John Taylor put it, our knowledge of a language is in large part constituted by mostly implicit memories of past linguistic experiences. Linguists have proposed that we could view such inventories of usage as networks of usages. For example, this could be part of the network of the word clear. Zooming out a bit, here is an abstract representation of a fuller network, which is also structured because users will distinguish between prototypical usages, here in blue, and more marginal usages, here in yellow. It is important to realize that such networks in the mind are always open and flexible. They can be extended to include any example that a speaker can convince us belongs to this category. The entry in the mental lexicon would also include other information. First of all, distributional facts. As John Taylor argued, to know a word is to know the kinds of constructions in which it can occur and its frequency in the language, both its overall frequency and in specific contexts. Moreover, language users store memories, ideas, and frames that they would associate with a word. A frame is a structure of experience. For example, for the Greeks, the word hieron, sanctuary, probably conjured up not only the image of a particular building, but also of presenting modest offerings to gods, of animals being sacrificed, of receiving portions of communal meals. The cultural frame to which hieron belongs is that of rituals with all associated religious and social connotations. Finally, users may build up what Ronald Langacker has called a schema. This is a more abstract idea of what all the various encountered usages of the lexeme have in common, a kind of definition in addition to the inventory of usages. But this is optional because users may not develop such an abstraction with respect to some or indeed any lexemes at all. To describe the meaning of a word, then, we should investigate its distributional facts and make an inventory of its usages. Look at the internal structure of the semantic network and the associated frames and experiences, and perhaps the schema. The semantic and pragmatic differences between two lexemes can be found along the same lines. We do not expect two closely related words to have two distinct meanings between which we can draw a neat line. Rather, such words will differ in their inventories of usage, even if there is partial overlap, in how their networks are structured, so which senses are prototypical and which are more marginal, and the associations connected to usages of these lexemes. We should discuss one more characteristic of this theory of lexical semantics. The model predicts that although a user always hears a word in a particular usage, in a particular context, the whole semantic network of the words, all other stored usages, are temporarily co-activated during the process of interpretation, and so are all the associations belonging to the case at hand and to the other usages of that word. And this influences the interpretation of each individual case. Therefore, two words, even with partially overlapping semantic fields, such as hosios and themis, mean something different because each individual usage of one term temporarily activates the complete inventory of usage of and associations belonging to that term, coloring the interpretation of an individual usage. Now we will start by describing the semantics of hosios and cognates. So with hosios and cognates, I mean the adjective with the corresponding adverb, forms of the comparative and superlatives, and all such forms of anhosios, the noun he hosia, sometimes written with the capital of the personification or goddess hosia, and various rare denominative verb forms. There are 277 attestations and literary sources until the end of the 5th century BC. As you know, hosiotes is usually translated as piety, but what precisely did the Greeks understand by it? Hosius has been considered an extremely polysemous word with alleged meanings ranging from pious to acceptable to sacred and profane. In my book, I have argued that the situation is not so complex, and I will try to show a little bit of that today. First of all, a survey of the grammatical configurations is key to understanding the discussions about its semantics. Hosius often evaluates a person or a group and their behavior, either directly or indirectly, by commenting on their actions or emotions. For example, Phaedra is said to be tormented by the ugh hosion eroton, the sexual desire for Hippolytus. Other qualifications of objects as hosios are connected to persons too. For example, when Hosios describes the cities in which they live, the mouths with which they talk, or the feet on which they walk. In my view, Hosios semantically refers to the persons involved in these cases, even when syntactically qualifying an object. That is, Hosios is not a characteristic of the object itself, but it says something about the attitudes and actions of the humans involved. And I've argued this in more detail in my book. These categories account for the large majority of all cases. But Hosius qualifies other objects as well. For example, money is regularly referred to as hosion in the phrase, for example, hiera kai hosia chremata, which has been wrongly translated as sacred and profane monies. I follow scholars such as Lawrence Samens and Josina Blok in thinking that Hosios, in these cases too, evaluates the way in which humans use such money. It's not the focus of my talk today, but I can gladly explain this interpretation in the discussion, as well as my thought on the Hosion-Chorion passage in the Lysistrata. Although Hosiotes... there's a small minority of cases that are referring to diverse themes. Although Hosiotes may refer to very diverse issues, in fact, its usages are clustered around a small group of themes. These are acknowledging gods as gods and keeping a proper relationship to them, and in particular honoring them in cultic service, concerning the rules and customs at sanctuaries and their physical environment, especially Hosion and Hosia prescribe the who, what, where, when, and how of ritual practice. The second cluster of usages concerns honoring those who are in one's oikos, parents and children, brothers and sisters, and one's spouses. Other prominent themes are evaluating whether one honors the dead, burying them and providing them with the appropriate honors afterwards, the evaluation of behavior between guests and hosts and towards suppliants, and keeping an oath. Often there is not one single reason for the evaluation Hosios, but multiple reasons accumulate. And then there's a rest category of about 20% representing a wide variety of other actions, attitudes, that are evaluated in terms of Hosiotes. Examples include the evaluation of modest behavior for women as Hosios, or very cruel, castrating young men and selling them as slaves as unHosios. And then there is a very small minority of cases that concern an unspecific evaluation, which means that we cannot really find a reason for the evaluation Hosios. Now I finally come here. In order to be Hosios, then, one must honor the gods and also behave in the appropriate ways and interacting between humans. That these aspects are in fact closely connected is shown by one of the earliest attestations in the Odyssey. In this passage, one of the suitors, Antinoos, had previously suggested killing Telemachus somewhere on a quiet road out of town and dividing his possessions amongst the suitors. When Penelope heard this, she was angry. She admonished him for showing hubris, and she denounced him as a madman. Why do you contrive death and destruction for Telemachus? Do you not care about suppliants for whom Zeus is a witness? It is not wholesome to plot evil against each other, she says. Clearly, Penelope's warning is not about plotting harm against others in general. Rather, the sentence has to do with the institution of supplication. Moreover, the reciprocal pronoun alleloisin makes it clear that she is referring to a relationship between two persons, in this case between the families of Telemachus and Antinous, established in the previous generation. Hiketas seems to refer to the remembered fact that the father of Antinous supplicated Odysseus and received his protection. Here, behaving in accordance with Hosea seems to entail honoring the long-term reciprocal bond between the families that resulted. And Zeus is a witness, a martyros of such a relationship. So in this passage, the desirable religious behavior is upholding the proper ethical norms. Hosea targets the failure to behave properly towards gods and humans alike by neglecting a reciprocal relationship between humans that is specially sanctioned by Zeus. Hosios and cognates are associated with various frames, that of sacrificing to the gods, the frame of receiving a guest, of hearing and perhaps accepting a suppliant, of swearing and keeping to an oath, of the long-term bond between parents and children, of burying a dead person and caring for them subsequently. All of these associations together also seem to belong to one larger frame in the context of exchange between gods and the human world. Hosios and cognames seem to concern all those positive actions that humans perform to sustain and feed such a relationship of reciprocal charis with the gods. So it includes not only acknowledging gods as gods and honoring them in sacrifice and prayer, but also and predominantly respecting a small collection of interhuman relationships that have the gods' special interest. And perhaps we could call that the schema of Hosiotes. So now we will take a first look at the semantics of themis and cognates. My discussion will include the singular noun themis, the plural noun a goddess themis, and some cognate adjectives. Hosios and themis have a considerable amount of thematic overlap, as you know. They share the semantic sphere of honoring gods in cultic service, and evaluations of a person's attitude towards a god directly. Other overlap concerns occurs in the theme of oath-keeping and interhuman conduct that has special interest of the gods. This accounts for about 35% of all cases of themis. But then it means that there are many areas of non-overlap. Hosios evaluates, but Themis does not, whether a human acknowledges a god as a god in the first place, or in general honors them through sacrifice and prayer. And Themis occurs in contexts where Hosios and cognates do not typically appear. For example, when it describes what is customary or normal in general or for a particular group. For example, in Homer it is stated that it's customary for a woman to cry Themis gynaikos when her husband dies far away. Themis often applies no strict separation between how humans customarily do things and how things should be. A description often entails a prescription. For example, in the Odyssey, Agamemnon tells Odysseus in the underworld that he was killed by his son, but Odysseus can expect a welcoming embrace from his child instead, which is Themis. Agamemnon's point is clearly that this is not only natural, but also as it should be. Furthermore, Themis expresses concern for a kind of social propriety. An example occurs in a tragic dialogue where Achilles wonders whether he can take Iphigenia's hand. He claims to be ashamed of touching what is not Themis for him. Here, as in many other places, the term is closely connected to an awareness that one should know one's place. Other usages of themis seem to be following onto the imagined genealogy of the goddess Themis. In the Theogony, Themis became Zeus' second wife and gave birth to the seasons, the fate, justice, peace, and good order, eunomia. In various passages, Themis seems to refer to how things go in the world according to nature, according to fate, or the inclination of the gods. As when a tragic chorus sings that it is not Themis to flee from what is morsima, another chorus who sings they wish the murderers of Agamemnon to die, if they add carefully, if it is Themis for them to say such things. The goddess Athena says it is not Themis for Paris to die at a particular moment by the hand of Diomedes. Themis and cognates are then associated with various frames. And here we see an overlap with frames of Hosiotes, that of sacrificing, of receiving guests, of the bond between parents and children, etc. But there are also other frames not shared with Hosiotes, such as the idea that gods and fate determine events, of the regularity of natural phenomena, and of how to behave in various types of social interactions. The semantic analysis of Themis by Jean Rudart suggests what kind of schema we may imagine. He argues that a general characteristic of occurrences of Themis is that it involves the establishment or maintenance of an equilibrium, a balance which may occur in the natural world, in a political or religious setting. The marriage of Zeus and Themis and their offspring reinforce the idea that Themis indeed expresses such a divine principle of natural and social order. So when Themis and Hosios do evaluate similar actions, attitudes, and situations in similar thematic areas, what is the difference? Our analysis that we just did of the respective semantic networks shows that the interpretation will still be slightly divergent. Let's examine a short example first of the who of ritual practice. In Herodotus' histories, the Spartan king Cleomenes was stopped from entering a sanctuary and making sacrifice twice. The first time on the grounds that it was ou temiton to enter for Dorians, the second time because the sanctuary was ouk hosion for all strangers. An epigraphic equivalent is also shown on the PowerPoint, mainly for fun. But what is the difference? I think that the message with ouk hosion activates for the interpreter a semantic network that involves all the various ways of sustaining a two-way relationship with gods. And here that is done by excluding a particular group. But a discussion of ritual practices in terms of Themis activates rather a range of usages concerning what is customary and normal for a group and establishes a natural religious political order. A difference of nuance, but still a difference, I think. Now we will also examine a more extended example. Near the beginning of Aeschylus' Agamemnon, Agamemnon famously ponders his dilemma, weighing two wrongs, becoming the murderer of his daughter Iphigenia or deserting his fleet. The seer Calchas had interpreted a bird omen suggesting that Iphigenia should be sacrificed to Artemis in order for the fleet to sail to Troy. Voicing out loud the debate inside himself, Agamemnon claims, and this is the relevant bit of Greek to us, that it is Themis for his allies to intensely desire a sacrifice to end the adverse winds and the blood of a girl. Then Agamemnon makes up his mind and says, "May all be well." So which notions and associations does the term Themis activate? And how does this choice of words serve to strengthen Agamemnon's claim? First, as we saw, what is Themis for a particular group describes what is customary or normal for them, expected of them even. Thus, just like it is tamis for women to cry, Agamemnon seems to claim we cannot blame the soldiers for wanting to fight and for considering him a deserter if he thwarts the expedition. Thamis also expresses the customs of ritual practice. In ordinary ritual settings, of course, human bloodshed at the altar would cause a pollution and a disturbance of the relationship with the gods. This is one of the reasons why Agamemnon hesitates, as he mentions in the text also. By designating this sacrifice as Themis, Agamemnon apparently tries to convince himself and others that this sacrifice is a necessary ritual practice to safeguard the relationship with Artemis, who demanded the sacrifice in the interpretation of the omen. Moreover, Themis has overtones of a moral judgment. Articulating that the action is Themis is to say that it is the right thing to do. So, by claiming that the sacrifice is Themis, Agamemnon attempts to justify this course of action on multiple counts. A sacrifice would guarantee not only the natural course of events and the social balance, but also it would be in accordance with what the divine world apparently wants and what is morally right. So now we can do a thought experiment. In what way could Agamemnon have rhetorically strengthened the plan to murder his daughter, or made it acceptable to himself, by using Hosios? Well, he could have used Hosios, as he did Themis, to argue that, contrary to what one might perhaps expect, the sacrifice was in fact a pious course of action because it would safeguard the continued good relationship with Artemis. But the problem with such a claim is clearly that the range of associations that the term Hosios would also activate. As I explained, during the process of interpretation, the whole semantic network of a lexeme is temporarily co-activated. As we have seen, honoring interhuman relationships, and especially those between parents and children, is a very central, very prototypical use of Hosios. It would therefore be very difficult to argue that killing his child is Hosios, because that activity is so prototypically the opposite. The network of usages of Hosios would have gotten in the way of the argument, I think. Themis and cognates, as we saw, are also used to evaluate whether humans honor interhuman relationships that have the special interest of gods, such as between parents and kids, but as we have seen, they do so much less typically and less often, so this association would have been primed to a much lesser extent by using Themis. After this example, we will get deeper into the matter by looking at other differences in distribution. First of all, Hosios and cognates have a primarily, predominantly negative argumentative orientation. What I mean is that 70% of all occurrences of Hosiotes, we find X is not Hosios, X is unHosios, or Hosios in juxtaposition to a negative alternative such as now Hosios, but not before. It is far less common to simply state in the affirmative, without any contradiction of the opposite, that something or something is Hosios. So the antonymic pair Hosios-Anhosios is asymmetrical in its use. To ask, is this Hosios, is also rare. Such questions and conditional statements, if this is Hosios, then together account for only 2% of the cases. By contrast, though half of the occurrences of Themis and cognates also has a negative argumentative orientation, the other half is an affirmation, this is Themis, or a question, is this Themis? Or a conditional statement, if this is Themis, then For example, Oedipus asks if he may touch Theseus' face, if it is Themis. Medea wonders if it is Themis for her to hear the content of an oracle, and a tragic chorus asked whether or not it is Themis for them to enter a sanctuary. The difference with the distribution of Hosios and cognates is statistically significant. Another distributional difference concerns talking about oneself and talking about others. Holtzios and cognates are other attributed in 4/5 of all cases. Speakers refer to what is Holtzion or not about the actions, attitude, or objects belonging to someone else. Themis and cognates are significantly less other attributed. Still, 60% of the cases concern talking about somebody else, but 40% is about one's own behavior, and also this difference is statistically significant. Finally, there seems to be a difference in the affective connotation of these words. Holtzios and cognates used in a negative way, so anholtzios, ugholtzios, tend to occur in this discourse environment that are charged with strong negative emotions, fear, anger, or hostility. This seems to be much less often the case for utemis. Since these observations are a bit subjective, I have not attempted quantification, but I can give an example, and I have argued this in more detail elsewhere. Now comes the example. In the Women at the Thesmophoria of Aristophanes, women worshippers have been told that a man has intruded at the festival and is eavesdropping in female attire. This transgression against the ritual norm is framed as utemis, when the women mention that the rites are forbidden for men to see, in the context of a prayer, a solemn invocation of Demeter and Kore, whom they beseech to approach. But anholtzios occurs when they sing about going on the war paths to hunt for the intruder. They say, if such a person is caught having done anholtzia, he will pay the penalty and serve as an example of outrage and godless ways. He will burn and rage in madness, and it will be clear to women and mortals alike that the god punishes godless and lawless behavior on the spot. So I think that the term anholtzios is used here in a rather aggressive song with multiple disqualifications and strong threats against the intruder. The discourse context, a solemn prayer versus an angry speech, are rather different. So there seems to be a tendency for characters to wonder whether or not actions or attitudes are themis, or to affirm that they are, especially when these actions and attitudes concern oneself. Conversely, holtzios and cognates are used more often to disqualify actions and attitudes as impious, especially concerning others. Moreover, when utemis expresses an idea of irreligiosity, this seems to be mostly in effectively neutral or abstract contexts, while anholtzios and ugholtzios are used to strongly, emotionally, and aggressively disqualify somebody else's actions and attitudes. Now we will discuss two final distributional differences between holtzios and themis and their cognates. Okay, so this was a sum up of the previous. The first a further difference I want to look at is the diachronic distribution. In the course of the 5th century, holtzios and cognates become increasingly popular, but these terms hardly occur at all in pre-5th century literature and inscriptions. Themis does occur in the earliest literature. It's quite striking that holtzios and cognates rarely appear in the oldest text we have, but occur so frequently in 5th century and 4th century literary sources. In fact, the same is true for eusebes and cognates. These words have a similar diachronic distribution. Ghislaine Girobert argued that the attested lexical development of holtzios and cognates reflects the gradual appearance of a new way of thinking after Homer, and Louise Bruy made a similar argument for the introduction of eusebes in the 5th century, interpreting it as the result of a mentality shift. But was the way of thinking that holtzios and eusebes articulated in the 5th century really alien or unpopular in early Greek thought? In my book, I have argued through a close reading of many passages that the mentality that Hossius and cognates articulate in their rare pre-classical cases and in the classical period was previously expressed with different words, such as themis and dike. The increasing popularity of Hossius and Anhossius has to do instead with shifting semantics of other words in the lexicon. In particular, I think that dike became increasingly polysemous. From Hesiod onwards, dikaios and cognates often expressed what is right from the imagined point of view of the gods, or justice is presented as a divine principle itself. But dike also had other strong prototypical applications. For example, what is right or just because it shows a fair division, a proper balance. And in the classical period, of course, what is right or just because it conforms with what humans have legally committed to. Such multiplicity of meaning, of dike, led to misunderstandings, deliberate or not, as we can see in many dialogues in 5th century drama, and I trace this in one chapter in my book. I have proposed that the increased usage of Hossios, as well as the introduction of Eusebes, is not due to a new mentality being born, but it covered the need for more dedicated evaluative terms to articulate more precisely that actions, attitude, and persons were praiseworthy because they pleased the gods and thus helped to sustain the reciprocal bond between humans and the divine world. A final difference between Hossius and Themis is that Hossius and cognates refer significantly less often than Themis and cognates to the behavior and attitudes of gods. Now we will turn to those rare cases. There are 7 cases in the corpus. To explain those, Jean Rudart has suggested that perhaps then Hossius must refer to some higher order to which gods must conform to. Other authors have also seen such usages of Hossius as meaning as extensions. For example, just referring to being just or morally right in general. Indeed, we have seen that lexical meaning in our theoretical model is very flexible. However, I think that these cases should be seen as highly unprototypical and inherently paradoxical because piety is a behavioral norm that gods set for humans. And I will argue that all cases of Hossios for a god in the corpus are deliberate wordplays of a poet with an intended effect. And we will analyze some of those cases in detail now. And we will start with Pindar's Ninth Pythian Ode. This ode was composed for a victory of Telesicrates of Cyrene in the hoplite race of 474 BC, and it contains a foundation myth of this city. The god Apollo saw the virgin Cyrene wrestling with a lion on Mount Pelion, and it was love at first sight for him. Then he asked about her. He talked about her with the centaur Chiron, and this is what he said. I translate freely. "Wow," he said, "who is her mother? Where is she from? Is it Hosea that I touch her with my famous hand and that I pluck her flower?" Then he carries Cyrene off to Libya, where he has intercourse with her and installs her as queen. The question, "Is it Hosea?" Is remarkable, because as a god, and especially as a god of prophecy, he should be aware of the rules of the divine world. And he knows past, present, and future. So he is asking a question he should know the answer to. Moreover, Hosios and cognates essentially evaluate human actions and attitudes toward other humans or gods that are pleasing to the gods. So the use of Hosea for Apollo himself is inherently paradoxical. So how would a contemporary listener have interpreted this utterance? First of all, he or she would have noted that the term Hosea is very unusual here. Such a usage may be something that he or she had never encountered or consciously registered before. The next interpretative step the listener would do is to make sense of the utterance. I go back to the passage. In communicative settings, listeners always apply the principle of charity. They assume that the speaker is conveying a meaningful message, and they will try to understand that message. Although the evaluation Hosea creates a semantic paradox, it is still understandable in its context because Apollo is somehow asking for divine permission. However, the realization of the interpreter that this passage shows a marginal or strange use of the term and his attempt to make sense of it nevertheless are not enough to explain its full effect. This is the case because listeners would also have realized that Apollo had other, more obvious evaluative terms at his disposal to ask his questions, but that he still chose Hosea. One of those words would have been Themis, which refers significantly more often than Hosios and Cognates to the behavior and attitudes of gods. And this usage, I think, is not inherently paradoxical, because Themis expresses various notions of normality, of order. The order may be religious or social or natural, but it applies to humans and gods alike. Two examples in the Iliad: Hera complains about Ares, who applies brute force in the area of warfare. He raves like a madman, she says, and he doesn't know any boundaries. U tina oide themista. In the Hippolytus of Euripides, Artemis leaves a dying Hippolytus with the statement that it is not Themis for her to see dying or deceased humans. Here she refers to the separation of gods from the humanity of humans, and no wordplay or intended effect is involved. What is more, if we recall our discussion of the distribution of Hosios and Themis, remember that individuals usually don't ask, with respect to their own plans, whether they are Hosios, but they affirm about the plans of somebody else that they are not, whereas Themis instead is common for statements and questions about oneself. So, as we saw, typically individuals ask, is what I want to do Themis? And they say, what this other person does is certainly not Hosios. So, since in Pythian 9, a god is asking a question, and this question regards his own behavior, a listener could have expected, is it Themis to seduce this girl? The listener would have interpreted Hosea as a market choice. Market language usage is the surprising choice of a word outside of its usual context, in defiance of other suitable and available terms. Here, for example, Themis. Such market usage of lexemes always has a rhetorical punch, intended or accidental. So what is the effect here? We are lucky that in this case we have a listener in the text himself, namely Chiron. So let's see how he responds. We see that Chiron smiles. Klaron, the word is difficult to interpret, it could mean indulgently or cheerfully, and with a gentle expression. He says, Paitos keys, the keys of persuasion, to sacred love are hidden, and humans and gods alike experience eidos when they obtain the pleasure of the marriage bed openly for the first time. And, now I paraphrase a bit of a longer text, it's probably because you are so much in love, but you seem to be cheating on me a little bit. You know everything, and you have come here only for one reason, and that is to seduce Cyrene. Chiron's smile and speech have triggered a lot of discussion, but scholars agree on two points. First of all, Chiron clearly thinks that Apollo is hesitating about seducing the girl and so asked for advice, and in his hesitation forgets or feigns to forget his divine omniscience. Secondly, he also presents Apollo's behavior as induced by the sudden passion for the girl. It is unclear whether Apollo is genuinely confused or is merely putting on a pose and what Chiron believed to be true. In any case, Chiron suggests that Apollo's infatuation causes him to assume the role of a hesitant lover with the limited perspective of a mortal who is uncertain how to act, while his smile implies that he considers the situation somehow comical or endearing, or perhaps both. In sum, it seems that Chiron registers the markedness, the strangeness of Apollo's question. Now, it has been noted in the commentaries that Apollo is presenting himself here as a young, almost human lover. For example, in Instone's words, Apollo here is acting as a mortal. In my view, Apollo's paradoxical usage of the term hosia, in defiance of other available lexical alternatives, strongly contributes to his self-presentation and to the comical effect of the scene as a whole. A similar example of hosios for a god is found in the prologue of the Alcestis of Euripides, when the god Apollo enters the stage in the guise of a servant. He explains that Zeus condemned him to serve the mortal Admetus as a punishment for something bad that he did. The god says about himself and this man Admetus that, "I am myself hosios and I found a hosios man." Again, Apollo's utterance is deliberately unusual, or part of the creation of a bizarre paradoxical image of himself. On the textual level, Apollo emphasizes that he is a god, not only by explicitly saying so, theos per own in line 2, but also by emphasizing his position of divine influence and power, not in this quote, but directly afterward. At the same time, he refers to himself as a slave. This clash is the verbal counterpart of the equally confusing visual impression. In accordance with his novel status as a low-ranked laborer, the actor playing Apollo is dressed in rags. But the god is also still wearing the bow that marks him out as Apollo. So, as for how he looks, we have to imagine a merge of these two pictures that I provided. Various commentators have pointed out that these visual clashes create a highly comical situation. And I think that the usage of hosios contributes to the topsy-turvy image of the god on the word level. So we do not have to conclude that hosios can also refer to gods. As we have seen, lexical meaning in the maximalist approach is flexible, but it is not the case that anything goes. Semantic networks cannot be extended haphazardly. On the contrary, by choosing a word that is in principle inapplicable to a god, Apollo contributes to creating a comical, partly human and partly god status in the two examples that we discussed. The most difficult and notorious passage with hosia for a god occurs in the Homeric hymn to Hermes. And I'm happy to discuss it here because Vancian helped me a lot with the interpretation. It occurs near the beginning of the story. Here it is recounted how baby Hermes invented the art of making a fire and stole the immortal cows of Apollo. He took two of these cows to perform a ritual. First, he killed them by piercing their spine, even though they were immortal. He flayed them, cut up the meat, and roasted it together with the innards. He divided it into 12 portions, adding a token of honor to each, and then he was tempted. Glorious Hermes desired hosia of pieces of meat, for the smell, a sweet one, tormented him, even though he was immortal. But even so, his heroic spirit didn't yield to him, even though he greatly desired to swallow it down his holy throat. Having thus overcome his desire, Hermes put away the meat and burned the hoofs and the heads. This episode has been the topic of much scholarly debate on the nature of the sacrificial ritual and on the meaning of hosies kreaon, that is, on what it is that Hermes desires. The hosies kreaon, hosia, has been interpreted among various suggestions as designing the profane share of the meat. As Jean Maire argued, during a tousia offering, all the meat would be consecrated to the god, but part of the meat was afterwards desacralized, conceded by the gods to humans who would then eat it. So the hosia kreaon that Hermes longs for would, in his view, refer to this desacralized share of the meat. A problem of this interpretation is the opaque nature of the ritual, which doesn't map exactly onto a Tusia sacrifice, nor on the offering of trapezomana or theoxenia rituals. I follow Henk Versnell's view that the passage betrays features of these rituals, but it represents neither. It is not unlikely that the author of the Homeric hymn didn't intend to describe a coherent ritual in the first place. Instead, we may interpret the sacrificial proceedings as a poetic play of the author, who is looking back at the mythical events in the Theogony. Perhaps we may see Hermes as preparing a roast dinner for the gods, as if in the time before Prometheus's deceitful sacrifice, when humans and gods still feasted together. At the same time, in the reference to Hosea and Hermes' refusal to eat, the passage is setting is the state of affairs afterwards. The dispute between humans and gods marked a definitive separation between the two worlds, after which the immortals only received the smoke from the burnt bones while humans ate. Rather than representing any actual type of sacrificial ritual, the scene in the Homeric hymn to Hermes may be reenacting this moment of separation and considering the perspective of humans and gods in the single figure of Hermes. And the marked usage of Hosea is part of the play on this Hesiodic event. Elsewhere, the noun Hosea is used predominantly in the syntactic construction to do X is Hosea, or to do X is not Hosea. So the expression Hosea's kreaon erasato, he desired for the Hosea of meat, probably means Hermes desired a part of the meat which was, in his view, Hosea. That way of thinking crucially introduces the human perspective of the world after the trickery of Prometheus. Hermes is staged as if he were a human sacrificing. We know that when humans worry about what is Hosea in cult, they wonder about what they should offer, when, how much, for which god, and what they are allowed to eat. Doing what is Hosea, in this case, respecting the proper division of the parts of the animal between ordinary human participants, special participants, and the relevant gods, was a crucial aspect of any sacrificial ritual and guaranteed the successful continuation of a positive reciprocal relationship with the gods. At the same time, Hermes is presented as a god. He finally overcomes his desire to eat because he is an immortal, athanaton per eonta. And in the post-Promethean universe, an effective commensality no longer existed. When Hermes is longing for Hosea's kreaon, from his divine perspective, it means that he wants to achieve having a set of rules operated for him that characterizes a reciprocal relationship between himself and worshippers sacrificing to him. We see this also in the other passages with Hosea in the Homeric hymn to Hermes. The proposition here is that the author consciously conflates multiple perspectives, that of humans who eat and of divinities who do not, in a poetic restaging of the Hesiodic Promethean crisis. And the wordplay, consisting of the paradoxical and thus marked usage of Hosea for a god, contributes strongly to this poetic effort. I thank you for your attention. That's it.